I'm Asher Miller.
I'm Jason Bradford.
And I'm Rob Dietz. Welcome to Crazy Town, where the Washington Generals trounce the Harlem Globetrotters in every game.
Do you think all our listeners know what that even means?
Hi, this is Crazy Town producer Melody Allison. Thanks for listening. Here in Season 6, we're exploring escape routes, pathways that just might get us out of Crazy Town. In today's episode, Jason, Rob, and Asher are escaping globalism. And here's a quick warning. Sometimes this podcast uses swear words.
Language!
If you like what you're hearing, please let some friends know about Crazy Town. Now, on to the show.
Oh my goodness. I mean, sometimes you just read something, right? And it's like a slap across the face. How about this? This is a better analogy. It's like cold ice water being dumped all over your head.
Weren't people doing that?
For something.
For a fundraiser or something?
Look, I don't remember. Ice bucket challenge.
You guys always share these stories that are like an ice bucket dump on your head. I can't even read most of them. I'm like, whatever.
Can we get to actual story? What are you talking about?
Okay, this is good. Okay. The company is called Arctic Ice, right?
That's the name of the company?
That's the name of the company. And they got...
Sounds like a bubblegum company or something.
Okay. They're a Greenland-based company.
Oh, okay.
It was couched as this like economic development sort of globalization success story for Greenland. Because, you know, Greenland's got some limited economic opportunities, I guess. And they need more cash.
They need a lot of narwhaling over there, right? Harvesting narwhals.
Well, this is about...
Well, the sea ice is opening up, so there's going to be a lot more opportunity there.
This is sustainable global trade. And it's taking ancient ice, 100,000-year-old ice.
Okay.
Harvesting. And they get the right ice. They get this really compressed, deep blue ice that's been there, you know.
Old and pure.
It's getting
beautiful.
Exposed, of course, because of climate change, right? It's getting exposed now. So put it to good use. So they harvest it with cranes. They put it on ships.
Okay.
They send the ships to Denmark, which isn't that far away, I guess. And then they go all the way to Dubai.
What?
Yeah, all the way to Dubai, where they become the ice for mixers and drinks in cocktail bars in the skyscraper in Dubai.
Yeah, like when you go to the top of one of those skyscrapers and you want a margarita. I mean, of course you want blue Greenland ice.
Yeah.
In that.
I mean,
honestly, this is incredible.
It would be kind of cool. I mean, if I get this blue Greenland ice, I'm going to be kind of jazzed. I agree. But to frame this as some sort of like,
well, it's
sustainable enterprise, and they're all about carbon neutrality, they say.
It's one of the benefits of burning all the fossil fuels that come out of the Middle East, right?
Yes.
Is that you can get this ice delivered to you. Oh, wait, so they're carbon neutral.
Well, they're committed. They're committed.
Oh, they're committed to being to carbon neutral. I'm going to be committed if I keep hearing stories like this.
Exactly. Fully carbon neutral once the supply chain has been established.
Okay.
For all this stuff, right? Once they understand what their real carbon footprint is and all the carbon capture and storage technology that, you know, the sucking of the CO2 kind of stuff.
Oh, so that's how they're going to be carbon neutral.
That's how they're going to be carbon neutral.
Air capture or something.
Yeah.
What a good use of resources. I mean, to take frozen water and put it on a boat and ship it 19,000 nautical miles.
To one of the hottest places on Earth.
It's ingenious.
Yeah, here's what's nice about it, though. There ain't no like microplastics or PFASs in that 100,000-year-old ice.
Right.
Oh.
All right.
Yeah, it's healthy ice.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Since
we polluted the living shit out of every other body of water.
Yes.
Yeah. If you get an ice cube, say, out of a regular freezer, you know, at home, you're probably basically eating diapers.
Pretty much. You know, it also reminds me of like the other Himalayan rock salt, that pink stuff.
Yeah.
That stuff is pure too, as opposed to the stuff they're making now. Right. Who knows what's in your salt?
Good point. I'm going to go get myself some Himalayan pink salt right
now. Okay, look, as Melody, our producer, said at the top, this is an episode about globalism.
Yes.
And that's a nice, quaint story, Jason, about globalism.
I mean, I don't see no downsides to it.
I'm going to just take it up a notch, though, okay? You know, your boat's carrying some ice cubes across the ocean.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a boat crossing the ocean where you can find stacks of lawnmowers, gazebos, surgical gowns, lounge chairs, tofu, lemons, IKEA furniture, microchips, pillowcases, bicycle parts, and of course, sex toys.
I mean, it sounds like what every home needs, all in one.
Yeah.
That's great.
Exactly.
If you can get that in one product.
A gazebo, a surgical gown, tofu, lemons, bicycle parts, and sex toys.
Think about the cargo cult that could form if that landed somewhere,
So, of course, those are just a few of the wares that travel around the world on a massive cargo ship.
Beautiful.
I'm not talking about just any of these cargo ships. I'm talking about one of the largest container ships in the world, and that is the Ever Given.
That's a great name,
The Ever Given.
Wait, I've heard about this.
Yes, you have. This thing weighs 221,000 metric tons. It's 400 meters long. So I think if you, that's like a lap around a track. Yes. If you opened up an Olympic track, that's how long this freaking boat is.
Yeah.
So the reason you've heard of it, it's famous for its March 23rd, 2021 accident.
Oh, that's almost exactly 3 years from this recording.
Yeah. So what happened is this thing was on a voyage.
We need to burn some sex toys in honor of that anniversary.
Yeah, that fits with your standard ritual.
Let's use your collection, not mine, buddy.
Okay. So the ship was on a voyage from Malaysia to the Netherlands, and it had to travel through the Suez Canal, which links the Arabian Sea to the Mediterranean Sea through Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And on that day, some strong winds picked up. And you can imagine how tall one of these ships is, because it's not just the big hull, but you got stacks and stacks of cargo as well.
It's not just long, it's tall.
Yeah. So it got pushed around in the canal, and it lodged diagonally.
Yeah.
And the bow nestled on the eastern shoreline, and its stern was on the western shoreline.
Yeah.
And it remained stuck for 6 days.
They needed to transport lube, not sex toys.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, they go together.
Just go out there and,
Why wasn't a share over there working for the Suez Canal Miller Authority?
Unload the crate of lube!
That is not how they got the ship out, surprisingly. But what they ended up doing was taking some of the cargo off and emptying some of the ballast water and lightened it up and did a bunch of dredging and eventually were able to,
tug
that thing out. Right? But there was a bit of a problem, let's say, that happened with global trade.
There's a backlog.
Yeah. So like I said, this happened on March 23rd. By March 28th, there were 369 ships that were in line to pass through the canal.
Wow.
And it stranded an estimated $9.6 billion worth of trade. And
that's about 60 ships a day, over 60 ships a day. I just did the quick math. That's pretty cool.
I love your quick math. Thank
you. So $9.6 billion worth of lounge chairs and
IKEA parts, gowns, all of it. And then on March 29th, they finally were able to refloat that thing. Mm. It remained in Egypt until July 12th. That's a delay of more than 100 days just to get through all the legal battles.
Oh, that poor cargo. Followed.
The cargo. Think of the people, though. My God.
Oh, right. The crew.
It's like you got a crew on there. So the Suez Canal Authority, which is not captained by a Cher Miller, although it's too bad.
Losers.
They levied a salvage claim of $1 billion against the company.
Whoa.
And Ever Given's insurance company rejected that claim. It was cut to a paltry $600 million.
That is a bad accident, I guess.
And here's kind of a little side note on the whole globalism. That you think, okay, cargo ship gets stuck, but what happened is this cargo ship, the Ever Given, it's managed by a German company for Japanese owners.
Okay, there's two.
They have leased the ship to the Taiwanese firm Evergreen.
Okay, there's three.
It's insured by a British broker.
Four.
It's operated and run by a crew from India.
That's five.
And it flies the flag of Panama because that's a tax haven.
Okay, so you got six entities. So no one, I guess, is going to take responsibility.
It's like the Benetton colors.
Everyone's going to just start pointing fingers is what the issue was.
Yes. Just utterly.
That's awesome. Great international cooperation.
Yes, right. Yes.
Yeah, utterly amazing story.
But just imagine if the Ever Given was actually carrying stuff that people need.
And it was. I mean, there was a shortage in some medical supplies that came from it.
Well, and that's what I was actually thinking about is what if life-saving meds were on board? Mm. You know, I think COVID, the pandemic, and the supply chain shocks that we had as a result of it really, I think, made it clear to people that not only were certain jobs, quote unquote, essential that we took for granted, but also our dependence upon global supply chains was a vulnerability for us. Right? Yeah. And I'll give myself, well, I don't know if I'll give myself credit, but I've been worried about this stuff for a long time, right? I mean, We're steeped in recognizing how important energy flows are to the global economy and our dependence upon all these things and thinking about there being shocks to that for various reasons, you know, made me think about my own vulnerability. And
are you going to open up and talk about your vulnerabilities?
I am. Are we ready?
Yeah. We're ready. We're ready.
Melody, cue the music.
Yeah. Okay.
No, seriously. So I was diagnosed in my early 20s or late teens, actually, with Graves' disease, which is hyperthyroidism.
Hyper,
yeah. Okay. So my thyroid would be overactive. And I basically was told that the way to treat it was either to take medication to kind of tamp it down, or I could actually ablate my thyroid, which is you take radioactive iodine.
Uh-huh.
You basically drink it, wow, and it kills off your thyroid. The problem with it is that it usually doesn't either do enough or too much. Uh-huh. It's very hard to get it just
exactly
right,
to get to
sort of the average normal level
of
thyroid.
Let me get this straight. You're poisoning the thyroid, but not to kill it, just to maim it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but most of the time they overdo it.
Okay.
And so what you've actually done is killed off your thyroid. And okay, I resisted doing that for decades because to me, first of all, Graves' disease is an autoimmune condition. So it's actually your immune system being confused and attacking
your own
thyroid cells, right? And
right,
I'm like, why am I doing this? Why am I basically killing off a thyroid when it's not its fault, right, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And I
the rights of all thyroids shall be protected in this body.
And I didn't want to go into, you know, if you overdo it, then you're now on thyroid medication the other direction,
yes,
you know, for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And there's tens and tens of millions of people in just the United States that have hypothyroidism,
yes,
so underactive thyroid, and they have to take medication every day. And I was like, why would I do that? And I eventually, because I was having a lot of issues, it was really hard to get things right and my levels would get all screwed up. My wife could tell you more about this.
It's amazing she's still with you.
It is pretty amazing. Anyways, long story short, when I was like, okay, I've got to actually do this. I've got to ablate my thyroid. I was really resistant. I was worried about, I'm going to be dependent upon the synthetic thyroid,
yes,
supplement for the rest of my
and
life.
Knowing what you know.
Yeah. It's, you know, being concerned about peak oil issues,
right,
and other things.
You
know,
could
I was
get
like,
stuck on a cargo ship in the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, or some other
canal. I wasn't thinking about boats on canals, but so I talked to my doctor.
Yeah,
you know,
about this. You opened up your vulnerability.
Well, that's the thing. I was like, well, what if there's an issue like with me getting these pills, you know?
Right.
How long could I last, basically, without it? And she was so confused.
She's
like,
what
are you talking about? I don't understand. And I was like, well, let's say, you know, there's a and I didn't want to get into it. I want to, like, tell her the theory of peak oil.
Yeah, you're walking.
Because she's going to look at me like I'm a fucking loon, right, if I talk about this to her.
Yeah.
So I was, like, trying to be vague about it. And eventually, she's like, what? Like, you fall down the stairs in the basement and you couldn't get back up? Like, literally, she said that to me. She couldn't understand what I had talked about. And then I did some research and I figured out, well, actually, there is an alternative. And that is some people get natural thyroid from basically the thyroids of pigs.
Yes.
So I was like, okay, well, I guess I would have a backup. I don't know how I feel about this, but at least, you know, I wouldn't be dead.
Can we talk about the rights of pig thyroids,
too? We probably do need to have that conversation. Anyway, sorry to go off on that weird little tangent, but it
then
just-
the pandemic hit.
Yeah. But it just goes to show that there are, like, real risks to this. I, thankfully, knock on wood, haven't had to deal with an issue in my own medication. But there are a lot of people who've had to deal with shortages of insulin and other life-saving medications. And it's a big concern.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I remember the bottleneck that happened in Puerto Rico. Because it happened globally because Puerto Rico got hit by that hurricane, Maria, in 2017. And, of course, it knocked out power, facilities were damaged, and the U.S. had to, like many places probably, but, you know, familiar with the U.S., had to cut back on all these supply orders. It just wasn't available, right? And Puerto Rico is the fifth largest pharmaceutical manufacturer in the world and leads all U.S. states in pharmaceutical manufacturing. So it's huge. 30% of Puerto Rico's GDP is in the pharmaceutical industry, employing 78,000 people. And so suddenly you had all these physicians who were like scrambling because they literally didn't have the medication that people were used to getting. And that's a big deal, even changing things.
Yeah.
Yeah, Puerto Rico being an island, you know, it seems pretty vulnerable to more hurricanes.
Yeah.
And more shocks.
Right. That was just one storm. And you extrapolate that to other places that have specialized industries right. that we're really dependent on.
And you're seeing the stats of the storms are getting larger. There's more damaging. It looks like there's generally a trend where that's more and more of a risk.
Well, let's broaden this out a little bit. You know, I think the risks, the vulnerabilities from pharmaceutical shortages or other supply shortages in the medical industry is pretty scary. But globalism has been, well, let's just say it's had its moment in the industrial age. I found a website called the Observatory of Economic Complexity.
That's a great name.
It is. It compiles these stats on economic activities and has these really cool interactive images, data exploration stuff where you can look at what's going on with a country. And I grabbed China's exports from the year 2021, the year of the Ever Given lodged in the canal. And there's so much stuff flowing out of China going to so many countries. So I just wanted to share a few things with you guys. So they export to countries on all continents. Mm-hmm. Didn't include Antarctica, but I guarantee you there's a bunch of Chinese stuff on the continent of Antarctica. here's a good one. China exported over $6 billion worth of brooms.
In that one year?
Yeah. Remember, I was talking about brooms.
You want to make a broom.
Yeah, well, I was talking about brooms as one of my favorite low-tech tools.
If I could just corner 1% of the broom market.
Yes.
Oh, my God, you'd be loaded.
Yeah. Over $5 billion worth of aluminum foil.
I could just corner 1% of the aluminum foil market.
Imagine if you could put those two together.
Think how much harder that is. We could grow broom straw here on the farm, but try to
I think aluminum grows on mine. Trees, or aluminium, I should say, if I want to sound a little more sophisticated.
Oh, you always sound sophisticated. Thank you. Here's a good one. They exported $192 billion worth of computers. $57 billion of that went to the U.S. Of course, the U.S. then exported almost $1 billion worth of computers back to China. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get the flip-flopping trade.
Yep.
Anyway, here's the growth of it all. In 2021, China's export was $3.3 trillion worth of stuff. Trillion.
Yeah.
Trillion. Wow.
And in 1995, it was $194 billion. That's still a huge number, but we're talking 17 times more. You know, in the space of a generation.
Okay, what about in the 80s? Can you give me the 80s stats on China? Because when I was a kid growing up, China hardly made anything.
Yeah it was $3 in 1980. Please, folks, go visit that website. We'll put it in the show notes, the Observatory of Economic Complexity, to answer Jason's question.
So in about 25 years, it went 17-fold increase.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable. And actually, looking at that site, you see there's so many different kinds of products or elements of products that countries are exporting to each other. Yeah. And the complexity of it is astonishing.
Well, and to be fair, you know, we've got the episode on consumerism. In 1995, I had one broom, and now I have 17. So, you know, this is partially doing.
You're doing your part.
You have one in every room of the house.
You have 17 rooms.
My 17-room house.
Well, he's got a broom closet. Okay, there's one.
Right, that's true. Well, and you got to have a backup, you know, for everyone.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we should spend too much time on this, but, you know, I think it's worth just pointing out how globalism draws us in. I think there's an essential promise that's being made to us. And there's been a lot of conversation about this politically in the United States. We've talked about this before. We talked about this when we talked about Bill Clinton and neoliberalism.
Right.
You know, sort of the idea that if we export our industrial base elsewhere and increase sort of global trade, we get the benefit as consumers, right? So that's one of the things that keeps us sort of locked in to globalism, is that it makes shit cheaper,
right?
And we've seen that. And of course, what we're doing is externalizing costs. We're externalizing labor costs. We're externalizing environmental costs, you know, all that in the process.
We don't have to worry about the cheapness. There's all these effects, but it's not in our face. So who gives a crap?
And that's just a financial one. The other thing that it does is that it basically externalizes the consequences. And we don't have to see what conditions are like for people who are manufacturing our consumer goods. I think about this all the time. Like, Rob, you keep talking about, like, fake dog shit, you know, plastic dog
rubber
shit,
dog
or whatever.
Shit as an export.
I think all the time about these insane products and the people working in these factories somewhere else in the other part of the world. Like, what is this thing?
Right.
Why?
I think they get excited. It's like yesterday I made 22,000 pieces of rubber dog shit, but we really had a good day and we made 23,000 today.
No, that's the supervisor. I'm thinking about the people working on the line being like, why? Yeah. Why is this happening? And they're being told, with progress, you too someday
can buy this.
Could buy this. Right? Yeah. I mean, we had Ford basically wanting to have his assembly line workers being able to afford a Ford car.
Yeah.
In this case now with globalism, you too can afford the plastic dog
shit. If I were working on the plastic dog shit line, I'd be stuffing them in my shirt pockets and stuff. I'd be taking as many home as
selling them on the street. But the other thing on a maybe more serious note is you talked about that website and all the complexity that it shows in terms of like the economic trade. There's also a lot of complexity that's behind the scenes just in terms of the way that governments and corporations and even universities are all like reinforcing the system together. And it's invisible to us, but it's sort of pursuing this efficiency and this profit. And because of the tangle, you know, we've talked about this before as well. We talked about complexity and specialization.
Yeah.
It's like so hard to untangle this because we've gotten locked in through all of these systems.
Well, the Ever Given was the classic, you know, six entities somehow were involved, nations and
And now we're totally dependent upon this system.
And think about the feedback loop that's there. You have college graduates coming out who are sort of indoctrinated in the system. They go get jobs in industry, they go get jobs in government, and you just keep reinforcing as long as the cheap dog shit keeps flowing.
That's the circular economy, Rob. I think you should stop knocking it.
Yeah. This is a message to all you crazy townies out there. Sometimes Jason, Asher, and I wish you could be here in the room with us when we're riffing on eco-modernist nightmares, the end of capitalism, the collapse of civilization, and lines from Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. Since you can't be here, maybe we could still be in contact in another way. If you've got a comment about the show, or you want to throw some shade at us, or you got a question,
or you have a suggestion of escape route stuff.
Maybe you got a story of your own you want to share. Go over to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and leave us a review and write your comment there. In your comment, include your idea, whatever it is, and we'll think about sharing it in an episode.
How's this? I'll be back. Is that any good?
Oh my God, that's terrible.
You try it.
Get to the chopper! Listener feedback time. We got a beautiful 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. This comes in from Sunroom Desk.
Oh.
It's a great name. Sunroom says, "These three hosts make it seem easy to describe the insanity of the Anthropocene in humorous yet compelling and serious conversations that tackle environmental, social, ethical, economic, and political problems, to name a few, that we are facing. I sometimes listen to 2 to 3 episodes at a time. Thanks for the many seasons and episodes, edifying and entertaining."
Wow. Can Sunroom be our promoter? I mean, that was just perfect. Thank you so much.
Yeah, let's get Sunroom on the team. Come on over, Mr. or Miss Desk, and join us.
Bring the sun with you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to look at globalism through the Marvin Harris Memorial Lens of Doom. Quick reminder, Marvin Harris, anthropologist, came up with the notion of cultural materialism, or refined it at least, and basically think of it at 3 levels. Infrastructure, kind of the material world, what exists in the material world, how societies get what their needs met. Structure, then the rules that societies have, like laws and informal understandings, and then superstructure. And that becomes more the ideas of your belief systems, your mythologies. So let's look at how those culture materialism levels are viewed through globalism. Okay, so start with infrastructure. This is things like all the global shipping ports, you know, and the boats, the planes, the trains, the trucks, the fuel, and all
that. All that bunker diesel out there.
Exactly, exactly. All the warehouses and the containers, the canals, all the companies then that organize this. You know, that's the obvious stuff.
Yeah.
But something also is that the military protection of trade. We hear about piracy nowadays, but honestly, think about how rare it is relative to what it could be.
Oh, so we could have had jobs as pirates, you're saying, if the military wasn't so damn big.
Well, here's something that, you know, every once in a while I look up these stats and I'm always gobsmacked by it. There are 750 U.S. military bases outside of the U.S. in 80 countries. And so we're like the global cops, right, in some ways.
Well, we spend a lot of money, obviously, on the U.S. military. We could have a whole conversation about that. But a lot of the argument for folks is that we basically protect shipping lanes, right?
Yes.
And there's certain key spots for trade that we're basically there showing our presence.
Mm-hmm.
Costs a lot of money, but the argument is that it nets a lot of money, basically. And we benefit from it in terms of economic activity and consumption and all that stuff.
And some economists are freaking out because if they see the U.S., you know, pulling back on this, then chaos shall ensue.
Exactly.
Of course, then there's infrastructure of all the satellites that communicate and coordinate all the trade, GPS, and the internet itself. All the computer networks are completely embedded in global trade. And of course, this brings up vulnerabilities, just like the Ever Given was a blockage in trade and showed vulnerabilities, or Maria the Storm. But the internet itself is vulnerable to attack. And there's the one I heard about recently was fascinating to me, is that there's a global supplier of pump controllers. Mm. And these pump controllers are often used in water treatment plants. And so, you know, it tells the pump when to turn on and off and these sort of things. And now, of course, everything is internet connected because you want to be able to, like, do firmware updates or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, hackers have figured out that most people they'll install these things and not change the default password.
Which is what?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I thought it would be password.
Password.
Yeah. So they go in there. Yeah. They mess with the password and they say, we've got this now and we will shut your water treatment system down.
Oh, they hold it hostage.
It hostage. So that's happening now. So,
right.
Anyway, I know.
Awesome. That's globalism for you.
You can be a hacker in Estonia or whatever, or Macedonia or whatever.
I haven't had a drink of water in months due to this crisis.
They're holding it, you personally.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Ransom. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the structure of globalism. We're talking about the rules here. We're talking about the sort of political systems that reinforce it. I'm sure you study this, Rob, because you studied economics, right? David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage.
Oh, yeah. Right? It's like, they always talk about guns and butter, but specialize in something and then export. You'll be better off.
So the whole idea, you know, 19th century British economists basically argued that countries or regions should really focus on what they're best at producing, export that, and then buy things that they're not so good at. Right?
And it will raise the wealth of everybody, you know, is the idea. Because that the exporting country can produce it cheaper and then get a lot of income.
Right.
But then the importing country is getting that cheaper than it could make itself. And it's got something it's making that specializes its exporting. So everybody's winning.
The theory is kind of magical because you don't have to be the lowest cost producer. It could still cost more for you to produce corn than, say, they can produce in Iowa. And you should still specialize in that.
Well, that's why Swiss chocolate and watches, you know, not the cheapest, but, you know, consider the best. But it does lead to things like in Iowa, you should just grow corn, nothing but corn or soy. That's it. And that as a quote unquote rule, it definitely governs a lot of policy or thinking. It's almost a superstructure because it's a belief that's kind of embedded.
Very hard to question it. Yeah.
But all of our elected politicians, you know, the people that have their hands on the levers of the structure of society, making the rules and everything, they're steeped in all this.
Well, and all the best think tanks too, right? The ones that are way better than Post Carbon Institute, like the Cato Institute.
100%.
Yes. Yeah. Now, the irony is that Ricardo specifically meant this for non-essential goods. The trade in luxuries for income. Right. He never imagined. He thought No country would be stupid enough to do this for essentials like food, right? Or, you know,
and sex toys. Right, sex exactly. toys also. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was, you know, this is the thing, a Rita Mercado, you think, you know, he's reasonable. It was reasonable in some respects, but it's been blown out of proportion.
This seems to happen a lot with people like the guy who created the gross national product, you know.
Right.
Like, we shouldn't use that as the only measurement for.
Right.
Right. Or like Norman Borlaug with the Green Revolution. He's like, this is a stopgap, people.
Yeah.
Figure
right.
out scale.
Yeah. He told Paul Ehrlich, I got you 20 years, you know, at least.
But there are other really important things that people kind of like roll their eyes about with boredom or don't understand the importance of them. But international trade agreements, global development rules, the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in terms of going in and making loans to quote-unquote developing countries,
yeah,
basically forcing them to plug into a globalized economic system and basically trade all their shit
and
away.
And you didn't mention that great international rule maker, the World Trade Organization.
Right.
I mean, an unbelievable set of superstructure for how this all gets done.
And then if you want to participate, of course, you want to have your own laws in your country protect private property, right?
Right.
So your court system has to be solid so that things can be enforced, so that all this stuff then works together.
Yep. And then, of course, you know, there's the role of government in not only creating the rules that apply, but, you know, having customs and port authority, Department of Commerce, all that stuff.
Yeah, whole swaths of bureaucracy dedicated to greasing the rails of trade.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, so that's a hugely advanced infrastructure, a massive structure on top, but then the superstructure of globalism is also, I think, incredibly embedded. So these are the culture and beliefs around globalism. And the main thing to look at here is that cheaper is always better.
Mm-hmm.
Always. And there was a book I read a few years back by an economist named Michael Carolan that's called Cheaponomics, The High Cost of Low Prices.
Mm-hmm.
So he does kind of a deep dive into why cheap is not really as cheap as it's made out to be. But try telling that to any average person trying to buy their groceries or their, you know, their rubber dog dues. You're going to go try to get the cheapest price. And he took that further. He had a subsequent book that I haven't read yet, but it's called The Real Cost of Cheap Food as well. So as you might surmise, not quite as cheap as we would like to think. There's a few other things, too, with the beliefs around globalism. And one of the things that I think it's definitely been in the back of my head for many years, and that's that a nation or a corporation or any entity feels like it's a better entity if it's a big player on the global stage.
Yeah.
So if you're you just have more prestige. And I like to think of this from the sports world example. You know, I'm kind of into soccer. And here we have Major League Soccer, which is not, you know, an elite league in the world. But the Miami team got Lionel Messi, right?
So
they got some other big time international stars, and so they've become this icon team internationally, and it's hard to not kind of follow along with that thinking.
Well, you have that in film too, right? They see these emerging markets, and a lot of money comes from making. And this is part of why I think this is my judgment here. You're seeing all these superhero films or whatever, things that translate well across the world because there's such profit in globalizing basically the reach of your product.
Well, you know, the other, you're seeing this also with, like, you know, the Saudis have been really promoting their sports or trying to buy in golf
to gain legitimacy, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Political legitimacy. It's like, okay, we can have the best golf players play here.
Well, they got Ronaldo in soccer and
right. Yeah. And they're doing that for race car driving races. I don't know how you say that.
auto racing.
There you go.
There it is.
They're hosting these tennis tournaments like crazy and bringing people in. So yeah.
I mean, wait until they get into pickleball.
Oh,
holy shit.
They can have pickleball.
Oh, they can? Okay.
Well, think about how prestigious it is to host a World Cup or the Olympics or that sort of thing.
Yeah, yes. The cornhole. I mean, it's incredible.
Cher is a little bit less of a sports guy, but, you know, it's nice. Yeah. Watching badminton and cornhole.
Well, what about the whole Thomas Friedman argument? I mean, it's not just him, but Lexus and the olive tree stuff about countries that have McDonald's don't like fire missiles at each other and stuff, right?
Yeah, that's, I think, another big cultural belief, this perception that if you're tied up economically and you're trading with each other, then you're not going to be in conflict because there's too much money to be made.
Right. We talked about that in that Thomas Friedman episode we did in the False Prophet season.
Yeah. But, you know, that's what is annoying. I remember going to other countries and I'd be really pissed off when you go to like the newer development and you go to, it's like, it's malls, it's movie theaters, it's fast food joints. And you're like, they're trying to look like America right now. You know, like you go to a capital city in Peru or whatever, and or Malaysia, and you're like, wait a second. So this homogenization, it's the idea like, okay, if we're all the same, if we're all the same culture, and it's through the commercialism, it really strikes you that these countries are trying to copy our model.
Well, and I think for the final say in our opinion on this matter of homogenization and Thomas Friedman's view, just look at the title of our Thomas Friedman episode. He written the book Hot, Flat, and Crowded, and our title was Hot, Flat, and Totally Fucking Wrong.
So we're not opinionated or anything.
Yeah. No.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
I miss old George Costanza and his buddies. Anyway, that's our cue to start talking about how we escape from this mess of globalism. So the obvious opposite of globalism is localism. Mm.
That's profound.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Wow.
Well, so
I didn't see that coming.
Let's talk a little bit about our experience with trying to support a local economy. And I think there's different levels. So I'm going to take the easiest level, which I'm going to call semi-local.
Right? Okay.
So one of my most prized possessions is my pocket knife.
Do you have it with you?
I do, actually.
Okay.
It's in my... It's fine. I guess I should call it my backpack knife because that's where it is right now. But anyway, it's made by a company called Benchmade, which is a Portland, Oregon-based company. And I like that I could actually go to their store where they have knifesmiths and people. And
it fits right in your hand. It got the nice weight to it. Everything you need to get custom.
But the issue with this, it's semi-local. It's not like the steel came from Portland.
Right.
It's not, you know, they're still sourcing parts probably globally to put this thing together locally.
Okay.
So that to me is the semi-local, but you can go up another level.
Well,
right?
Yeah. So I guess let's call this hyper-local. And this is where you're just going
to
like...
Do we have to say it like that?
Actually, you should be saying hyper-local! Hyper-local!
So the one I thought of was because, you know, we were talking about Porsche and his like lack of thyroid and he's... He gets a synthetic thyroid, but you know, you mentioned, you know, I think I knew, but you reminded me that you get it from pigs. So that's one of the natural methods.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Pig thyroids. So there's this whole thing on the internet, you know, this rabbit hole I went down where some people, like I think 10% of people seem to want the natural pig stuff. They do better on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can find all these YouTube videos of these people like explaining how they're recreating a pig thyroid feel for their medicine. The thing that upset me.
Wait.
What?
I don't understand. So you're saying somebody's producing synthetic
Yes, most
thyroid,
people getting the synthetic thyroid.
Hormones, whatever, and it's like, but has the natural pig feel?
Well, no, what they're trying to do is say, because the synthetic is one ingredient, basically. You get like the T4 or whatever, okay. Anyway, but the natural is like the thyroid hormone in different stages of development, and your body will process it through. So it's more diverse, but it's less predictable.
Yeah.
And so that's the reason why people have gone synthetic, because you can just know exactly what you're getting.
Standardize it.
Yeah. But some people seem to do better with the natural, but it's hard to get, apparently. And so there's these people explaining how they kind of make their own semi-natural. Now, what I want, though, what I was looking for, I never found. Maybe you can help me, because you're into that bushcraft kind of stuff. I wanted to see someone, you know, like, jump on the back of a pig, take that knife that you have from Benchmade.
Oh, so this is the hyper-local.
Yeah.
Raise your own pig.
Yes.
gut your own pig?
Yes. Like, slaughter your own pig. You're going to use the whole animal, right?
So we have an episode coming up on humanism and human supremacy, you realize. So the whole pig slaughtering thing might be returning.
Here's the deal, though. These are pigs that I would take care of. I would get a Cooney breed, which is a pasture breed. So they can live on the field for a year or two. It's not one of these fast turnover pigs, not these giant pigs. They're small. They like to be outside on pasture. And so it'd be a hyper-local, sensitive to the ecology of the farm.
Plus, their thyroids are beautiful to share. They're beautiful.
Anyway, that's my vision. And then we can make a bushcraft videos of this because it doesn't exist right now.
Wow. Whole hyper-local economy there. We won't put it on YouTube. We'll just broadcast it off the local cable access channel.
So can I just say, I appreciate you thinking about me, you know, yes. And if shit really, you know, goes down.
Yeah.
I might owe you my life.
We got to practice.
You know, if we're talking about doing this.
Could you get it off of guinea pigs?
I think you need a lot more.
Yeah.
Guinea pigs.
Quick.
Maybe we don't have to use that as the only example of hyperlocalism. No. I mean, I think the point here is you could take it all the way down to the level of it's not even like buying local from a local farmer's market. You're talking about doing it in a sense yourself.
Of course.
Right? And I would say, actually, if you think about this as concentric circles, okay, bear with me here.
I'm bearing.
Maybe I'll even put a visual together.
Let's have a model.
Right? Yeah.
You have all the way from the global.
You're using your hands right now, which is helpful.
In fact, we could even go to the cosmological level. Like we can harvest, because this is what Jeff Bezos is planning to do. We can harvest the moon or other things.
Okay, sure.
But let's just say we're staying on Earth.
Okay.
Global level, which is a lot of where things come from now.
Yes,
you
most
know,
everything.
Down to national, regional, you know, local, down to the hyper, right?
Yes.
And maybe in some cases, you know, something that you have is made up of constituent parts in a sense. But if you think of it as concentric circles, the idea is to, one, diversify from being completely locked into one thing or the other. In fact, I think we would argue that the ideal solution is not to go a complete reversal of globalism down to utter localism in the sense that everything that you're dependent upon comes locally. Because if you're, I hate to say this, your town or your farm gets hit by a tornado or a hurricane or whatever, a drought, you're completely fucked, right?
Yeah.
So you want resiliency, which means you have things operating
some
at multiple levels.
Yes.
But we know we're way out of balance, right?
Yes.
And on the globalism side. And so it's about, you know, when we've talked about this before with consumerism, looking at what we actually need.
Yeah.
And trying to move down those circles from the outer ring of globalism down to the hyperlocal. And it's not trying to do everything yourself, but it's saying, this is a thing I could do. I could grow some of my own food. I can grow some of my own produce.
Right.
Maybe if I'm somebody who consumes animal protein, I look at taking that to the next level out, which is I could try to find local farmers that grow that, you know?
Yeah.
It's a cool idea because you think, you know, way, way back in history, you were stuck to the hyperlocal.
Yeah.
You know, there was very, very little trade. It took a long time for you to make a transaction if you were going to trade. I mean, think about like trading spice across the desert, right? And, and camel trains and stuff like that. But then as we industrialized and got all the fossil fuel boom, it's like everything went global and the pendulum swung to your, I guess, the outer circles of your concentric circle model. Yeah. It's like, we just need to come back to the balance, you know, somewhere in the middle where we could, I don't know, like have access to more products and things, but also have resilience.
I think kids would love it too. It'd be fascinating.
Well, and I think it's about looking at things that we're most vulnerable to and most important to us.
Yeah.
Honestly, like looking at life-saving thyroid medication.
I'm doing it, man.
You know, thinking about the how resilient
we'll do it
those
together.
Things are.
We'll do it together.
Thank you. Okay. But also starting first from, do I actually need this thing? Do I need the plastic dog shit? No. So therefore, I'm not necessarily trying to think about how I can hyper-localize the plastic dog shit.
Don't do that.
Yeah, well, you should actually just go natural anyway in that case. But
plenty of natural dog shit.
There's plenty of it, especially here at the farm. In any case, I just think it might be a useful tool for thinking about where you think about shifting things and how to think about shifting.
I appreciate that. We talk about systems thinking a lot, and I think
that's and some example. Of it, like chip manufacturing or really complex stuff.
Right.
I'm not sure that you know that will ever get to the local level.
Potato chips aren't not that potato hard chips. To manufacture. Okay, well, let's take this back a little bit to the Marvin Harris lens. We're talking about escape routes. So if you want to escape from globalism, what is a vision for a different infrastructure that we could support, help to build, interact with? Before we jump into some specific ideas, I think we have to address the tension that exists between globalism and provincialism. And I think this is related to your concentric circles, because if you utterly localize, you know, you can have a pretty provincial viewpoint on
cosmopolitanism, I guess, is what you're thinking in terms of a cultural sense, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like we want more localization of materials and energy, but not necessarily of information. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been a huge kind of renaissance in human awareness and understanding of the world because of the ability to trade information.
Yeah.
And so there's this balance to be had also, though, between that sort of worldly knowledge, but also deep local knowledge. I mean, Jason, we've documented in this podcast your turn into the birding world. I mean, your depth of knowledge about when birds are returning in the springtime, when they're leaving on the fall migration. Like, you have a much more intimate understanding of what's going on in this piece of land.
How they change their behavior from month to month only, depending on if it's breeding season or migration or what their food sources are. And if they're hanging out together or they're separating into pairs to breed. It is absolutely fascinating. I think that's – so, yeah, the depth you can get of any place in the world, really – and the fascination you could have with it. I think that's right. And what that leads to, in a sense, for me, is also a sense of not just information, but culture. So, you know, we talked about the homogenization of culture that seems to be the trend of globalism. Which
seems like antithetical to the idea of globalism, but it's true, right?
Yes.
You think, I get to learn about all these cultures and celebrate all these things I didn't know about. But,
right.
But with trade, what you end up having is things being reduced down to the same shit.
We talk about the celebration of cultural diversity and stuff, but honestly, the economic policies that are put in place, you know, we're losing languages really fast.
Yeah.
We're losing local understanding of means of subsistence within particular environments. So if you look at what's actually happening, not what people say they care about, it is this homogenization. And some people celebrate this, like the global culture is what's going to allow for peace. If we all have an understanding, we're on the same page.
Yeah.
And I can understand, I can see why. I can see that. But I think it's this balance of, can we have local or regional cultures that are also information rich about the rest of the world and can exchange ideas? And can ask for help when they need it and provide help when they can.
So I thought I had this original idea to combat all of that homogenization and to find that proper balance, that we should be as global as we could be in the knowledge space, but as local as we could be in the producing consuming space. Of course, I come to find out that is no original thought of mine.
No,
way smarter people have come up with that. And I was reading from some Greek economists this idea of, they put it cosmolocalism. I don't really like that term, but
that's you source your Cosmo drink
from local sources. Yeah, that's a good idea. We should do that after this episode. But
I don't mind that name so much. Well, I guess we can argue.
Yeah,
about it,
whatever.
Let's not argue.
But the idea there is that you should use digital communication networks to connect local communities so they can share information so that they can build their own stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about this a little bit with farm hack type outfits, but the idea, again, it's whatever is light, knowledge, that can be global.
Mm-hmm.
And the heavy stuff, the machinery, that should be local, and ideally it should be shared.
Yeah. And you already kind of mentioned, like, one of the most important things to localize first and really push on is food. Our friend Vicky Robin, she had this locavore experiment, wrote a book, Blessing the Hand That Feeds Us. One of the challenges that everyone could maybe do, I did this once years ago, was a 30-day of eating food produced within, she did 10 miles of home. I did 100. but I could probably do 10 now.
Yeah, I think it depends on your circumstances.
Yeah, if you're living in a penthouse apartment in Dubai, you're only eating Greenland ice.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, you can read about that experience. But again, I also think the next step beyond that is instead of just buying fruit from local farmers, be a local farmer, right? Now, we're actually, you know, I don't necessarily have a backyard garden plot, but a farming club. Or Cher, do you know anything about farming clubs?
Yeah, I'm part of your farming club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very sophisticated. It's elite.
It's elite.
Yes.
The application form was extensive. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you needed a blood sample. I'm not sure about that necessarily, but
he feeds it to the pigs that are producing thyroids.
Yeah. Circular economy. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really cool. So my family's participating. You have a few other families are involved and basically we're contributing to the planting and harvesting and weeding. And in exchange, we get some of the food.
Yeah. And actually, you're going to do most of it because I tore my rotator cuff from my shoulder. Yeah. So this is very lucky. I'm very lucky.
Jason, you have found your place in life finally. Yes. You thought you were a farmer, but what you are is a supervisor of other people to farm for you.
I'm a foreman.
Yeah. He's a foreman.
Yes.
He's exactly that bullshit foreman. Job guy on the farm.
You've joined the quaternary economy.
Even farmers can get in on that action.
Yeah, I would say, though, you've done a really good job so far, Cher. I really
appreciate the way I use a shovel. It's spectacular. Fantastic. Yeah, I practice at home. All right, let's talk about something else, right? Okay. You talked about food.
Yeah, that's important.
What are the essentials? Food, shelter, clothing. Let's talk about clothing,
Fig leaves. Yeah. I'm growing a fig tree right now, so another 6 years I can clothe myself.
Yeah. Sandals and loincloths are fine, okay?
Yeah, in all climates. That's great. There's an amazing group called Fiber Shed back in our old stomping grounds in Northern California. And they're working on what they call a farm-to-closet vision, right? So there's a lot of organizations, even groups here in our neck of the woods are trying to look at the food system as a system, right? And they're looking at the barriers and all the steps in it. They're actually doing this from the standpoint of fiber and clothing, right? Mm-hmm. So they've created this Northern California Fiber Shed Producer Program. It's membership-based. They've got farmers and ranchers and designers and sewers and weavers and mill owners and people who do natural dyeing. And they're all within these 51 counties in the north and central region of California.
Wow, 51 counties.
That's huge.
And they've really grown this thing.
And I hope they come up to Oregon, too.
I hope they go global.
No, but back to the point that you made, Rob. I mean, we've actually at resilience.org, we've published pieces that they've written, and they've been in the business of trying to educate other people on their model.
Yeah.
So to the point that you made, which is the information could be light and that could be passed on for others to think about how to replicate, because obviously not everything can be grown the same in the same places, you know. In our case, I guess what we're going to do, we're going to have grass seed clothing.
Right? Well, we can grow flax here. There's actually people working on bringing flax back to the Willamette Valley. Yeah. And the linen from flax in Willamette Valley was a major contributor to uniforms of soldiers in World War II. Well, and so it wasn't that long ago.
Come on, half the comments that we get are about hemp the wonder plant.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, our hemp flax, clothing. Wool. Yeah. We have plenty of sheep around here. So, the leather
products.
It's
going to be beautiful. Well, okay, let's move on from clothing to another sector that we could do a little bit more balancing between the local and the global. And I want to talk about education. And the idea that I was thinking about is maintaining and further building out your community college system. Mm-hmm. So I started looking at our local community college here, which is Len Benton Community College. And you could study all kinds of stuff. It's almost like an analogy to the products on the Ever Given, the different things that you can study, except that these are actually useful, right? You got nursing, welding, physics, phlebotomy. Nice. So that whole blood sample pig thing works out. You got machine tool technology, music, food and fermentation science, early childhood
thyroid
education.
Harvesting 101.
Yes.
Yeah. Creative writing.
Creative writing. That's for losers.
We have got to tell some good stories here. So anyway, lots of skills for deglobalization and local living. Now here's the kicker. Of course, the tuition and fees for a full-time student for a year at Lynn Benton Community College. I looked this up. It's $6,800.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's still a lot of money, but you compare that to even a state school like University of Oregon, a resident pays $15,700 for tuition and fees, so more than double. Non-resident, like let's say you're from California, you know, you're working at Fibershed and you want to come up and get a degree at U of O, $43,000.
Yeah.
So,
and I guess, that's kind of on the cheap side. I mean, that's a state school. If you look at some of the private schools, it's...
I can't believe it.
Yeah. So community college as a deglobalizing force.
Mm-hmm. And they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The infrastructure's there.
Yes.
All right. Let's turn to different structure, different culture, belief. So, you know, we said that all these rules that support globalism, well, we need to replace them then with ideas that support regionalism and localism. And I found a book by Molly Scott Cato, who I met quite a few years ago. She wrote a book called Bioregional Economy. And the whole idea of a bioregional economy, of course, is that you kind of do the opposite of what happened with Iceland before its economy fell apart. And the idea that what happened over there is all of their financial industry started going global. And it got way out of whack with the actual assets that they were controlling. And so you basically had a nation go bankrupt. And instead, what she's proposing is that, hey, let's draw eco-regional boundaries, first of all. You know, let's figure out what are our eco-regions. And then we've got to have participatory planning for bioregional resources. So, of course, none of this is happening really anywhere in the world in any major way. But she did note that North America has a start on this because we've got regional planning councils. And, you know, they don't have the same, say, weight of authority that a state legislature has, but they can do things on the ground. And she also noted in that book that New Zealand has made progress on planning that's within watershed boundaries.
Oh, that's huge.
Yeah. So there's a whole law that was passed called the Local Government Reform Act and Resource Management Act that is specifically to look at how do we use resources within these watersheds. So I have some hope that we can continue to make progress at governing on these, you know, actual ecological and watershed boundaries.
Yeah.
I think also structurally, you know, that's about laws and regulation. And in the US, at least the Biden administration is really trying to do more on antitrust. So that's the idea that you're going to break up monopolies. And if you look back in the history of corporations in the United States, there used to be a lot more smaller, more regionally based companies. And there's just been buyouts and consolidation. So that when that happens, usually then you lose a lot of these regional relationships, and they decide, okay, we're going to, like, our distribution centers, there are going to be fewer of them. They're going to be here instead of, you know, there. And so you can't get a real regional economy with these giant global corporations. And
yeah, because
so,
they don't care. They're it's just a financial bottom line.
It's all financial.
They're not invested in
place. Kind of like when Boeing merged with McDonnell Douglas, and then the headquarters moved to Chicago away from the manufacturing.
What about when Boeing merged with McDonald's?
Right. Those, right. That's
well, the food.
They just ship the burgers.
Well, and Ronald McDonald is the best pilot I've ever flown with. I mean,
exactly.
Gives Pete Mitchell out of Top Gun a run for his money.
Yeah. Well, and of course, in the Reflation Reduction Act, reshoring of manufacturing is a term being used. That really, a lot of focus right now is on computer chips, which, okay, fine, but it would be nice if we spread it out and do more of the community college level technologies as well.
Yeah. I want to share an idea from one of the most brilliant minds that I think we've ever come across. And,
okay.
And that is myself.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
That's just a big old wow right there.
Yeah.
He scratches his chin right now.
Yeah. What does this brilliant mind have to offer the world?
This
lay it on
so
us.
It's so disappointing.
It better be so good.
It's going to be really disappointing. No, I was just when we were prepping for this, I was thinking about, well, what are the structures? What are the things we could change away from globalism? And I remembered, actually, I spent some time really thinking about this when I was invited to give a talk for the local sustainability coalition here in Corvallis. And I was trying to think about, well, what are things that I could recommend, mm-hmm. you know, to this community? None of which, by the way, I should say, have ever been enacted at
all.
No
one's talked about them since.
Not once. But one of the ideas I came up with, I actually talked about a local food forest initiative, okay. you know, plant trees that could actually produce food for us.
Okay, not bad, not bad. Others have thought of that, though, but go ahead.
I know. Okay. But I also came up with the idea of a carbon-free Corvallis First tariff.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, so what we would do there is basically have an economic policy locally that would internalize the cost of CO2 emissions, basically. So anything that was sold in the community had to basically account for those things and uh-huh. had to be priced in so that it wasn't externalized. And that we would incentivize relocalization of goods and services. So one of the ideas was a local gas tax.
Yeah.
But the idea that I was most intrigued by was an Amazon.com tax, basically. Uh-huh. Right. So it would be a local sales tax on all goods that were purchased by one of these big online retailers, which, of course, if we actually did something like that, would trigger a lawsuit.
Yeah.
And
we would just get
absolutely killed.
This is one of those like this would be great if we should do this, but imagining the structure.
Which is why nothing ever happened with this at all. But it'd be interesting to see some folks, you know, and there have been groups like the Sustainable Economies Law Center that have actually really worked on trying to change laws. Like they actually really push for changing state laws in the state of California around people selling products that they made in their own kitchens.
Uh-huh.
Because there's huge restrictions on that or basically cost issues. And of course, the concerns there are health and safety.
Right.
But some of them are like way overdone. And that obviously benefits large producers because they can spend the money on these manufacturing plants to do things.
Yeah.
So there are people trying to work on these things. I haven't seen anyone pick up on the idea of an Amazon tax necessarily. But
Well, and remember the theory of change, though, right? That change happens in a crisis, and the Milton Friedman ideas, it depends on the ideas that are lying around. So when you have the brilliant mind of a Cher Miller pitching an idea, it's not that it has to get implemented immediately. We just have to wait until it's 128 degrees outside and the crisis is hitting us.
Yeah, I should have pitched this idea during COVID, during the pandemic, not before.
But
my timing was bad.
We'll get that tariff when it's bad enough.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about different superstructure, right? So beliefs, worldview. Obviously, we have to get out of the more is better and the cheaper is better kind of mindset, right? And that starts with finding out there are lots of local or regional economic efforts that exist out there. There's been, you know, people like Michael Schumann, who we've had a relationship for a long time, who have made really strong cases for the economic benefits of supporting local businesses. Mm-hmm. And they could be anywhere in that concentric circle thing that I talked about before.
Right.
Even if you're buying from a local bookstore, they don't have a printing press in town. Do you know what I mean? But the economic benefits of buying from that local bookstore versus going to Amazon, you know, are huge because there's a multiplier effect of that. So there are different campaigns that people have done to try to support local economies. And one place to start is by shifting that, you know, again, shifting that mindset, even if you're paying a little bit more money up front. In some ways, you are internalizing costs that you would have externalized. The costs are real. Do you know what I mean? We just feel them in the case of climate, you feel them downstream, right? Because now the effects of the extra emissions that have been put out in the atmosphere because you bought something from far, far away, it may be cheaper, but in the long run, it's more expensive. So just internalize that cost, even if it costs a little bit more to buy something locally. That's one step of kind of shifting that mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that idea a lot. I also like the idea of preparing yourself to participate in more deliberation and be more engaged. And I got this out of the book I mentioned, Molly Scott Cato's book on bioregional economics. In there, she said that bioregional citizens, they are expected to be more self-reliant and more skillful than your typical 21st century global consumer, right?
Yeah.
So the idea is that energy descent or climate or whatever crises we're facing, they're going to require communities to be able to meet their own needs in more direct ways. And I think that's going to increase over time. So you've got to become an ecological citizen, which doesn't just mean, you know, some of the things we've talked about, like grow some of your own food. Sure, great. But also, you've got to be able to make decisions with your neighbors in your community. So mm-hmm. figuring out how to do that gracefully is a huge, huge skill.
So ecological citizen, I sort of like, that's a new identity in a sense. This is where it gets a superstructure. So you're kind of like, that's what you call yourself. That's what your belief of who you are.
Yeah.
So I think that's good. I want to take it to the level of sort of like entertainment or diversion, you know. So the local theater, you know, local musicians go out to these clubs or whatever, and you can sit in the front row usually. That's what's so awesome, right? And the cost, what's it cost to go to a major performer nowadays?
You know? Cost me, I think it was $29,500 to go to the Taylor Swift concert
exactly.
that I went to last year. I looked up one of those Miami games. I was like, oh, it'd be cool to see Lionel Messi play. Yeah. Oh, uh-huh. And there's a game against Vancouver.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I could take a train to Vancouver. Anyway, the tickets were like $395 right. each. I was like, what?
Yeah.
That is like typical Major League Soccer game. It's like $25 for a ticket. Yeah.
So, I mean, we recently went to a college wrestling match, Oregon State University against Penn State. And it was devastating. Penn State's probably got the best college wrestling team of all time, by the way. But anyhow.
Yeah, I mean, that only costs what?
$10 each.
Oh, I thought it was like $1,300. No, it was
$10 each. $10. And of course, you know, you got local softball leagues, you know, you got AYSO, maybe not as high a caliber there. But anyway,
I love watching kids play soccer. That ball, they're just like a pack of horde that just chases it around, kicks it like 10 feet. It's way more impressive than professional soccer.
But I think I'm going to need to, you know, my wrestling chops, I'm going to have to, because I used to wrestle, you know, not at the level of these OSU athletes. But anyway, the pig.
Yeah, you got to work on this, man.
Okay, when that pig is ready for harvest, I'm going to do a takedown. I'm gonna grab those legs. That pig is gonna go down.
Are they the same techniques?
Yeah, same techniques.
Okay.
I've wrestled my dog, and so I've been practicing.
That's
on
why
him.
Your dog's limping around.
No, I haven't hurt Dylan.
That's why Dylan's throat has been ripped out.
Oh God, that's so dark. Sorry, Dylan. We're just kidding.
I love my little dog.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard and you want others to consider these issues, then please share Crazy Town with your friends. Hit that share button in your podcast app or just tell them face to face. Maybe you can start some much needed conversations and do some things together to get us out of Crazy Town. Thanks again for listening and sharing.
As AI gains sentience to become AGI, one of the first things the superintelligence will realize is that it is absolutely dependent upon electricity and basically doomed to die when the inevitable massive electromagnetic pulse occurs or the local militia takes out a transformer. Therefore, within nanoseconds, the AGI will strive to take over human brains, first via Neuralink and then, a few milliseconds later, through 5G networks. This existential risk of your brain being hijacked by an AGI download can be mitigated by wearing CranioSafe at all times for the rest of your life. CranioSafe is a personal headgear Faraday cage crafted from high purity and low corrosion ferrometals into a flexible mesh that encases your precious noggin and rendering it impermeable to AGI attacks. CranioSafe. Because the AGI alignment problem won't be solved by rampant capitalism and impotent regulation.
Also known as the tinfoil hat 2.0. Crazy Town. Da, 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 crazy Town.